We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. It's 1 o'clock and time to jump at Media Matters here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we're going to be talking live with the executive director of the leading information group on the public relations industry in the United States that has grown into much more than that over the past 2 years. Our guest will be Lisa Graves, live on the phone with us from her home outside Madison, Wisconsin. But before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
A good deal of noise was made last month when the Department of Justice moved to block AT&T's merger with T-Mobile. In an era where regulation has become a four-letter word, it was an act that seemed to blindside the telecom giant, which had been buttering up policymakers with the help of their aggressive spending on lobbying and campaign contributions for years. But late last week, another heavy blow hit AT&T's merger proposal when seven state attorneys general joined the DOJ's lawsuit seeking to block the merger. Joel Kelsey is political advisor with Free Press. He explains why this move is so significant.
Other than this represents the elected law enforcement officials that represent a third of the United States population standing up for their consumers and saying this deal would hurt the residents of the various different states represented, I think the biggest significance for those watching how this merger plays out and the DOJ suit plays out, it means that it makes it very difficult for a settlement to be reached in this case.
Now, in addition to having the DOJ sign off on the merger, AT&T would have to convince seven attorneys general from both political parties and the judge presiding over the case.
So I think that this makes it very, very difficult for AT&T to try to salvage their deal by selling off different types of assets, trying to get rid or drop some of the spectrum that it's acquired on some of the local markets where it may have too much. I think the DOJ has been very clear that it views this market as a national market. You're eliminating one of four competitors, and you're allowing the top two firms, AT&T and Verizon, to control close to 80% of the market share, and that's just too much for this merger to represent a move that could benefit consumers' innovation and not have a dampening effect on price increases.
Kelsey said that there were likely a number of reasons that the attorneys general from California, Washington, Illinois, Massachusetts, New York, Ohio, and Pennsylvania took action. But perhaps most significant were those who clearly saw from the facts, not the politics, that the deal was a violation of antitrust law.
I think some of them were probably motivated by, you know, what called them into public service in the first place, the responsibility to protect the citizens that elected them. And this is a merger that would raise prices, that would limit consumer options, that would chill innovation. We throw those terms around here in Washington, meaning the entire country, but I think that has a real impact on all of the different states.
Although the decline in newspaper readership is nothing to celebrate, it has the benefit of reducing the impact on our trees and forests. But since we value more news available to more people, there must be a way to keep the newspaper industry strong while also protecting our woodlands. Fortunately, a plan is in place to do both of those things. Two nonprofit organizations, the Green Press Initiative in the U.S. and Canopy in Canada, recently released a newspaper industry environmental vision. They're asking newspaper publishers to adopt sustainable practices that don't rely so heavily on virgin wood fibers. Shannon Benz is a program manager with the Green Press Initiative.
The vision decision is really an opportunity for the newspaper industry to set some collective goals to stimulate innovation within the industry to work toward a more environmentally sustainable product and a more financially sustainable industry.
Newsprint made in the U.S. and Canada is about 35% recycled material on average. Ben believes that going green is not only good for the environment, but it's also good for business.
Quite simply, conserving resources saves money. The vision extends beyond paper impacts to water and energy use within their print facilities if they print their own paper. Of course, reducing waste and all of those things help the bottom line. But if we look at the triple bottom line, there's a bit of social responsibility that comes into play here. And certainly newspapers who are in the business of serving the public should be, and many are, becoming more socially responsible with regard to their environmental impacts.
The newspaper industry has been bleeding subscribers and competing with an intensifying online world. Ben says a better footprint might improve newspapers' appeal to environmentally conscious readers.
I know some people have just dropped their print subscription altogether because they're concerned about all the paper that's going into their recycling bin or the garbage bin in some cases. I think if newspapers were to take a more proactive approach to making their print editions more environmentally sensitive, they might be able to hang on to subscribers.
The Association of Alternative News Media, Now Magazine, and Embarcadero Media are the first newsprint publishers to endorse the vision. Ben says people can help others follow suit.
I think it would be important for the public to communicate to their local newspaper that they would like to see them endorse these goals, asking them what they are doing to reduce their environmental impacts, and just basically let them know that they do care.
To read more about the newspaper industry environmental vision, visit greenpressinitiative.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. Our guest today is the executive director and editor-in-chief of the Center for Media and Democracy, Lisa Graves. Lisa Graves previously served as the chief counsel for nominations on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee and deputy assistant attorney general in the U.S. Department of Justice. Among other roles, she's been at the Center for Media and Democracy now for a couple of years and has been a guest on the show about a year ago. Lisa, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot has happened in your life in the last year and to the Center for Media and Democracy. It seems like almost 100 years ago, considering what's taken place.
It has been a very busy year. We spent the spring covering the Wisconsin labor uprising here in the state, in our home state. And then this spring, we had a whistleblower come to us with a trove of documents about the American Legislative Exchange Council and how many of the bills we've seen speeding through legislatures across the country had already been previously voted on behind closed doors by corporations. We've been busy this spring.
And Lisa, I want to go into the ALEC treasure trove that your group has worked on and exposed over the year and what's in there, and talk in general about what the work of the Center for Media and Democracy is doing. But a little bit of background for listeners who are familiar with the Center for Media and Democracy. It was founded many years ago by John Stauber, who was a guest on this show several times and was Lisa's predecessor as the executive director. And you can go to the website prwatch.org, where all their material can be found. And the publication PR Watch is still available for an online subscription. Is that right, Lisa?
Yes, it is. It's available by signing up online, but there's no subscription cost.
Hey, is this a great country or what?
We stopped the paper publication in 2009, and it's all electronic, and it comes to you free of charge.
Also, you can find at the prwatch.org website one of the really extraordinary resources that's available for anyone interested in sort of contemporary politics and how power works in the United States, something called Source Watch. And I urge people to just click on that at prwatch.org or just go to sourcewatch.org. There's a truly an immense mountain of research on corporations, on public relations, on groups, data, links. When students find out about this, there will never be another book checked out of a library. There's so much material there. And what sort of traffic does that website get, SourceWatch?
We get several million people each year around the world who come to SourceWatch. SourceWatch is a wiki, and so it's similar to Wikipedia, but it's not the same as Wikipedia because we don't require a neutral point of view, meaning we require things to be documented. They might be unflattering to a corporation, and we don't allow that information to be whitewashed. The site has a wealth of information about greenwashing by corporations, as well as about the corporations, their CEOs, politicians, their the lobbyists, and front groups formed by corporations to try to spin the news and push their PR campaigns. And we also have an enormous amount of articles now about the ALEC corporations and ALEC politicians and these think tanks, these so-called think tanks that have emerged over the last couple of decades to really push industry statistics, industry-based so-called science on a number of issues. And so millions of people come each year, new people come each year to the site, and anyone can sign up to be a contributor to help tell the story, to help write the history of these groups trying to influence public policy.
Another person associated with the Center for Media and Democracy, who our listeners, I think, are familiar with, has been a guest on the program twice and has received quite a bit of national acclaim, is Wendell Potter, who, of course, was the person who left the healthcare industry, where he worked in public relations, to expose the practices of the health insurance industry and its sort of deceptive claims and its own chicanery as it tried to shape and influence healthcare policy. So the group has a rich tradition, but what's interesting to me, Lisa, is how much the Center for Media and Democracy and PR Watch have gone from being a watchdog group that exposes information, get stuff out there, to being actually a journalist organization that actually is now writing journals and doing it. And you, this year I noted when I was doing research for the program that the Center for Media and Democracy actually won the Sydney Award, which is given by the Sydney Hillman Foundation for investigative journalism, which is really an extraordinary accomplishment.
Well, we were certainly honored to receive that award this month. The Sydney Hillman Foundation has a long history, over six decades, of honoring investigative journalism. In recent years, they have awarded their annual award to Bill Moyers for his journal and to Jane Meyer for her work on the dark side on Dick Cheney. And so we're certainly extremely honored to be acknowledged by the Hillman Foundation with the Sydney Award. But I do think that the center's books over the years since 1993, since its first book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, that John Stauber spearheaded, the center has been involved in investigative journalism and investigative reporting. But what we've done in the last over the last year is really turn our daily, our weekly efforts into more of a reporting focus rather than a re-reporting focus of PR going on across the world. And so our books, the books that are available on our site, I think are investigative reporting in their essence and really expose a lot of the misinformation and disinformation out there. But I think that what you'll see if you go to our site, if you haven't been there for a while, is a really excellent quality stream of reports, both about Wisconsin and national issues, in which you're hearing information that you may not ever heard before, new information that we've uncovered.
Our guest, Lisa Gray, is the executive director and editor-in-chief of the Center for Media and Democracy, and you can find all about them at their website, prwatch.org, or you can go to sourcewatch.org, which we've already been talking about. You know, Lisa, when I hear you talk about the sort of reporting function that the center is increasingly playing, although it's always had an element of that, I can't help but think from my own work that this is a statement to some extent about the decline of traditional newsrooms, that it's not enough for you to expose stuff and then expect journalists from newspapers and newsrooms around the country to grab the material and run with it. You've got to run with it yourself, or no one might pick it up and run with it.
Well, I think that's right. You know, when we look at the coverage from the Associated Press, from the wire services, you know, there certainly is news and in some ways the appearance of news, but it's a lot of he said, she said quotes by politicians, and not a lot of really uncovering what the facts are behind the claims being made by those politicians and other people in power. And so we certainly saw that in Wisconsin with the lack of national coverage for the most part, although there were some extraordinary exceptions by Amy Goodman, by The Ed Show on MSNBC. But for the most part, the national media, both in print and on television, did a very poor job of covering what was really an extraordinary and historic set, a confluence of people from all walks of life coming together to object to the extraordinary agenda being imposed by the new governor, Scott Walker. We saw the terrible coverage really going on across the country and knew that it was essential. We just had the advantage of being here on the ground that we would focus our team on really getting that story out and getting it out through every vehicle possible, because it just wasn't being covered adequately, in our view, by the you know, traditional press.
Lisa Grace, for our listeners, most of whom are based in East Central Illinois, but we do have, thanks to the internet, listeners all across the United States and the world for that matter, but only a very small minority are from the state of Wisconsin or from the Madison area, maybe 0.1%, if that. So for people who weren't, like yourself, able to experience this personally, participate in it, observe it directly, what do you think people outside of Wisconsin didn't know about the revolt or the uprising or the demonstrations that you saw, that you're trying to communicate to people about what actually has happened there?
Well, I think there were a number of things. I mean, first of all, the national media was very late to coming to the story. It's been sort of interesting. I'm sure many of your listeners have seen the extraordinary coverage of a couple hundred Tea Party activists here and there across the country. And here we had literally tens of thousands of citizens coming out in the freezing cold weather, people from all walks of life, people who were students, the elderly, disabled, workers from every type of employment, standing together in the cold in protest. And so it was portrayed in some ways, certainly on Fox News, as, you know, thugs and hippies. It was portrayed even by some of the Republican politicians in the state as basically hippies who were just reliving their glory days from the 60s. It wasn't that. It was really quite amazing. And in fact, one of the things that was not well covered was how, for such a long time, how the police were not excluding the protesters, despite pressure from the politicians to do so, that the police, in essence, were in many respects standing with the protesters. And ultimately, after there was extraordinary pressure by the Walker administration, now much of the Capitol is being policed by the State Patrol here in Wisconsin, which is led by the father of two of the leading Republicans in the State House. And so I think that what we were covering was, you know, really on the ground what was happening and what this meant for the nation, what this meant nationally. And I think that the impact of our coverage and the coverage of a number of others who were here was to really help inspire other people across the country to see that it was possible to stand up to these forces. And what we saw was in state houses across the country, in Seattle, in Ohio, people who joined together to protest this extraordinary wave of legislation that was seeking to strip people of their rights. And it had been many years since citizens had really taken to their capitals to demand their role, their voices be heard in democracy in that way. And I think if it hadn't been covered, not just by us, but by a number of people on the ground here, people would have thought it really wasn't possible, wouldn't have taken those steps. So I'm not sure if that answers your question fully, but I think that that sort of local coverage, which is more than just what a spokesman for a politician says about what's happening or what Fox News says when it puts palm trees in the background of supposed protest photos, you know, I think it helps tell the real story and inspire people to know that they have power in our democracy as well.
Our guest, Lisa Graves, the executive director and editor-in-chief for the Center for Media and Democracy, based out of Madison, Wisconsin, but a national group. They have the website, prwatch.org, also sourcewatch.org, where they cover all sorts of issues and have a wealth of information. The phone lines are open today. This is a live version, this September 25th, 2011, of Media Matters. So please call us at 333-9455, our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Lisa Graves, the Wisconsin demonstrations, uprising protests, grew out of a situation where the Republican Party swept the 2010 elections, controlled both branches of the state legislature, the upper and lower branches, as well as had the governor's office. So they sort of had a trifecta of power. And they implemented and instituted, and they're in the middle of implementing a series of sweeping and draconian reforms, very few of which they actually campaigned upon, if any. And what your group has done at the Center for Media and Democracy this year, and what you won the award for, was exposing how much of this reform agenda was not developed in Wisconsin by Wisconsin voters or Wisconsin politicians, but came out of this very shadowy corporate backed group called ALEC, which creates a sort of model legislation that's being plugged in every state where the politicians that are sympathetic to them have gotten control of the government. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. ALEC, in our view, is a corporate bill mill. What it does is it, in essence, produces these McBills or these copycat pieces of legislation. And then legislators take those so-called model bills, which are really corporate wish lists in many respects, and introduce them in their state houses, cleansed of any reference to the fact that corporations already previously voted on those bills through ALEC's task forces.
What does ALEC stand for? When did they start? What does it mean? Who's involved? How do corporations play a role in it? You know, some of the basics for listeners who might not be familiar with the group.
Sure. Well, ALEC, and we say in house, not to be confused with the other famous ALEC, Alec Baldwin. This is about ALEC Exposed. And ALEC is a group that was founded in the early 1970s by a right-wing activist named Paul Weyrich. He was really working closely with sort of fundamentalist right-wing politicians in Illinois and across the state, across the states. And he, along with some others in Washington, really took up this charge that had been developing among some of the corporations and some of the sort of hard-right ideologues to create an organization to sort of marry corporate interests and right-wing social interests. And so that's the sort of founding and birth of ALEC. It was founded around the same time as a pretty famous memo that was circulated by the chief counsel to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, in which there was an urging that millionaires, and now billionaires in essence, should get more involved in politics to push corporate interests, to push aside sort of public institutions' role in society and really turn the keys over to the corporate sector. And so ALEC has been around for about, over 40 years, but it had been a much more quiet organization in some respects over the first couple of decades of its history. In the early 1990s, the Koch Industries and others got involved in ALEC, and the Koch brothers, the famous billionaires, two of the richest men on the planet, who own one of the major energy conglomerates in the world, they got involved, and ALEC was actually in a great bit of financial trouble, and they bailed it out. They gave it a loan of almost $500,000 to keep it afloat, and ALEC reworked its business plan in the late 1990s and made a much more aggressive effort to get corporations involved and funding its efforts. And in the last decade, ALEC has just been growing in power and influence. It has, it says that it has over 2,000 state legislators that are members. That's out of a total of over 6,000 state legislators in the country.
So they have one-third of the state legislators in the country are members of this group.
That's right. Now, membership is cheap. It's $50 a year, but some legislators are so cheap they don't even pay their dues themselves. They have the taxpayers pay it for them. But all those 2,000 legislative dues amount to basically less than 2% of the entire budget of ALEC. ALEC's budget is largely from corporate for-profit interests as well as some not-for-profit philanthropies like Charles Koch's foundation and other right-wing philanthropists. And so ALEC has a budget of about $7 million a year, give or take a couple hundred thousand, depending on the cycle in recent years. The bulk of that budget comes from everything but legislative dues, although it describes itself as a membership group for legislators. In fact, what ALEC is a group in which corporations and politicians sit on task forces. These task forces cover every area of the law affecting Americans' rights, education, privatizing prisons, expanding criminal sentences, addressing tax policy, reducing the ability of states to raise revenue, trying to limit the number of people who can vote through voter ID or voter suppression laws, efforts to limit the ability of the Environmental Protection Agency and other environmental agencies to protect the quality of our air, our water, limiting the rights of Americans who are killed or injured by corporations, limiting the rights of workers to unionize and to have the rights that workers have had in this country for many decades. Just a host of laws have been initiated, in essence, generated by the model legislation that ALEC produces. And what ALEC does, the unique thing that we discovered as part of our examination of the whistleblower documents, was that it has, at present, over 850 bills and resolutions that it has approved. And we learned that corporations and politicians that are on those task forces vote as equals. The politicians who are elected to represent you give an equal vote to corporations who are not elected to represent you to approve what's known as model legislation. That model legislation sometimes is enacted in its entirety by state legislatures through a public process. Sometimes parts of those bills, ALEC bills, are enacted. But what you're not told when a politician introduces one of those bills is that it was already pre-voted on by corporations through the ALEC process.
Our guest, Lisa Graves, you've just been listening to. Lisa Graves is the executive director and editor-in-chief of the Center for Media and Democracy based in Madison, Wisconsin, and has been around for a long time. They are responsible for PR Watch, and you can go to that website, prwatch.org, and also Source Watch. We're talking about the research, the award-winning research that the Center has done on ALEC that we've just been dealing with and many of the issues they've covered. And you know, one issue you just mentioned that I'd like to talk about, Lisa, it deals with the voting issue. Paul Weyrich, the founder of ALEC and sort of a noted conservative activist for decades, famously said that, you know, for conservatives, it'd be better if fewer people voted. You know, he said, you know, the idea that we want everyone to vote, just that's not really where it's at. Our chances go up if we get the voting turnout way down. And, you know, I think one of the things that's been taking place in sweeping form in all the states where Republicans have complete control have been really extraordinary efforts to limit the ability of people to vote. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. If people haven't had a chance to hear Paul Weyrich in his own words, there is a video of that, an audio of that that's available on our site. He really does say what you said to a group of fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists, about how it's not in their interest for more people to be voting. And I knew Paul, actually, when I worked in Washington until I moved to D.C. a couple years ago. He actually passed away a couple years back. I think that he carried those views right up until the very end. He and I actually had a bit of a dispute over some issues related to that when I was working for the ACLU. In any event, what we see in ALEC is sort of the way to make that sort of vision legally binding. So this spring and this summer, in continuing really to this day, a number of the state legislatures have been taking up these bills which are being promoted as preventing voter fraud. And what they do is they change the rules for what identification you have to show when you go to vote. The fact is, as many people who do vote know, you often can go and show your ID. You can show a utility bill that shows that you've been living at your house in the time period prior to the vote and vote. What these bills do is they make it much more difficult for you to do that. If you have an ID that is not approved by this new law, you can't use it, even if it shows that you're you. For instance, for the elderly, people who don't drive, there's a requirement that we've seen in Wisconsin that echoes the ALEC legislation to require state-issued ID, not federally issued IDs, and other things of that nature. The effect of that is, in many respects, to make it more difficult for people to vote, in particular students. Sometimes students will have an ID from their hometown before they go off to college. They'll have their driver's license that they got when they were living at home. They'll go to college somewhere. They'll be really actively engaged in that community. They live there. They vote there. But what the bill would do, in essence, would be to make it difficult for them to vote in the city in which they're going to college. They'd have to travel home to vote or go get a brand new ID. With new address showing their current residence. Under current law, typically they could show proof, a utility bill, but you can't under bills like the one that passed in Wisconsin. And so many people think that there is a political agenda at stake with these sorts of bills, and I would tell you that ALEC describes itself as a bipartisan or nonpartisan organization, even though 99% of its politicians that are in leadership are Republicans. And we know that after the 2008 election, when there was an extraordinary surge in students voting, a surge in African Americans in inner cities voting, and others voting, that ALEC took up voter ID or voter suppression legislation, in our view. It approved a model bill, and parts of that model bill have been circulating across the country this year in 2010. We know that model legislation on voter ID has been around for decades, but it really didn't get influence and power until after the 2008 election and after ALEC took it up and basically put it on the agenda as an item for its right-wing legislators to push this year.
Our guest, Lisa Graves, you've just been listening to. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today, September 25th, 2011. So if you'd like to call in with a call, the lines are open at 333-9455. Our toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. Lisa Graves, this issue of voting is really foundational to a credible democracy. I mean, if the franchise, citizenship, political equality, the entire legitimacy of the system rests upon this. And if you have a system in which people are disenfranchised, it is not a legitimate system. It's really pretty elementary. And this goes back all the way to the Greeks and the first time the notion of political democracy was broached. What are the arguments publicly, what are the arguments in favor of this system of requiring people to have certain types of photo ID to be able to vote? I mean, the case can't just be we don't want poor people and students to vote. That would be at least not in public. What is the public argument, and how credible is it?
Well, the argument is voter fraud, and that's the line that has been pushed primarily on the Republican side for the last decade or so, is that without voter ID laws that will have extensive voter fraud. But the fact is that if you look at the U.S. Election system over the last two or three decades and you examine any documented cases of voter fraud, it's extraordinarily rare, exceedingly rare for there to be any evidence that there's widespread misuse of identification of people pretending to be someone other than themselves. And voting, we have one of the best systems in the country, in essence, in terms of the number of prosecutions of voter fraud. The prosecution is very rare because the act is very rare. Instead, what we've seen actually is that Americans have learned really since 2000 that what the bigger difficulty is in terms of the legitimacy of our elections is actually getting our votes counted. Having our votes count, it has been an extraordinary challenge. There are leagues of lawyers across the country, a lot of them, as we saw in the Bush v. Gore decision, who are, in essence, trying to prevent recounts trying to stop the vote from being counted, trying to impose rules that close the polls, even with when hundreds of people, if not thousands of people, are waiting outside after they worked all day, came and stood in line in the freezing cold rain in November to vote. People, primarily on the Republican side, have been pushing to close those poll doors, like at 7 p.m., for example, even when people were in line beforehand, and those issues have been litigated. I think we have a real crisis in this country on actually enforcing the right to vote, our sacred fundamental right in a democracy, which, you, as you point out, is essential to the legitimacy of a democracy. We've seen that we have a lot of difficulty in this country getting recounts, fair recounts of elections when elections are called into question, when they're exceedingly close. We've seen problems with the ballots. We've seen extraordinary difficulties with the new voting machines, with the computers being used, and the lack of paper trail, the lack of paper ballots, the lack of proof, to a way to ensure the validity of the percentages of people who voted in an election. We have a crisis in this country regarding democracy in our elections, and it's not about voter ID fraud. It's about actually having elected officials count the vote and making sure that our vote counts. But there's been a sort of political agenda, I think, to focus on this boogeyman of voter fraud, and to put that on the backs, like from a rhetorical standpoint, on immigrants and people of color, while actually trying to focus the debate in that way rather than on the real crisis we have in this country, which is a documented problem, getting our votes counted and counted accurately.
Our guest, Lisa Graves, the phone line here at Media Matters, 333-9455, or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to a caller right now. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Lisa Graves.
Yeah, getting them counted and not having felony disenfranchisement, as was also happened in 2000, which people don't seem to remember too clearly. That's the real threat. The ALEC work is exceptionally good, but I wanted to ask about a couple of other things, and maybe one of them is sort of a strategy question, actually. The other one is about the, I think you or an associated group was doing the work on the packaged press release stuff, very obvious in some cases. I still see some of that, maybe not as much as I used to. I wonder if they have an update on that. The other thing is about the Citizens United and what can be done in that regard. Even some of the people that supported it on the Supreme Court thought that there should be disclosure, and it wasn't. No legislation to that effect was enacted. So I'm wondering whether we can sort of develop a culture of whistleblowers or something inside the media industry that would, tell the tale about where the money is coming from when this deluge of material starts raining down on us in the future. Is that clear?
Yeah, it is. Thank you very much, caller. Lisa, two parts to that question. Take them at your leisure.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for the call. And also, I do agree with you. We have the U.S. Has the highest prison population in the world, which means we have the highest number of people who've served their sentence, paid their debt to society, and in many states are not allowed to vote ever again. I think this is also a tremendous disservice to what it means to be a citizen in this democracy, in which your citizenship is a key element of that is the right to vote. The caller raised two questions. One was on our reporting on what we've called fake news, which is these prepackaged press releases by corporations that have been used in videos, video news releases, in essence, by both corporations and the government in the Bush administration to pop into news shows and look as though they're news when they're in fact not. They're basically product endorsements or program endorsements. I think that problem definitely continues. We recently received notice from the FCC that one of our complaints led to a fine of a Fox News station up in Minnesota and another station for their use of these video news releases without disclosure to their audience. But there has not been an active effort by the FCC since basically a year after our initial set of complaints to really be policing the news stations for their use of these prepackaged PR so-called news segments. But we do have information on that on our site on prwatch.org, and if you're interested, you can definitely go see the latest information on that on our site. On the issue of Citizens United.
Yeah, maybe if I can stop you right there, Lisa, sure. Since this is an issue near and dear to your heart and has been something central to your work for a long time in the center, just a little background on that for listeners who've heard the term possibly but really don't know quite what it means, what the importance is.
Sure. Thanks, Bob. Well, in 2010, the United States Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, five guys in the majority, all appointed by Republican presidents, made a really dramatic, I would say radical ruling, reactionary ruling, really, to expand the rights of corporations in our country. What they did was issue a ruling that struck down bipartisan campaign finance reform, rules that were intended to govern and regulate the increasing role of money in our elections, the role of these so-called nonprofit groups that are created to run ads influencing elections. What the court did in a decision last year was say that Congress did not have the power to regulate these groups, to limit their ability to spend money influencing elections. And it did so claiming that the First Amendment protected the right of corporations and others to spend money in an unlimited way on ads influencing our elections. So since that decision, in fact, before that decision, the Center for Media and Democracy, under my leadership, has been working to respond to that decision, which we anticipated was going to go that way with the change in the makeup of the court with Senator O'Connor's retirement. That decision came down, and as the caller points out, the writer of that Supreme Court opinion did express a view in favor of disclosure. The idea was, well, the idea was basically money is speech, which we reject, but the idea was that money is speech and it should be able to be spent in an unlimited way in the marketplace of ideas, but there would be or could be or should be disclosure of who's spending the money. The reality is that current laws are completely inadequate to get at disclosure. In fact, what we know under current law in both the states and nationally is that many of these groups, groups like the Club for Growth or groups that we've discovered this spring that basically operate out of a post office box, a UPS box, like Citizens for a Strong America and others, they don't disclose at all who their donors are. You have no idea which millionaires or which corporations are actually bankrolling these ads. And millions of dollars in ads are being spent in our elections with no disclosure of the actual financial underwriters. Congress has been powerless with its political makeup to pass any law since the Supreme Court's decision to require more disclosure of who's actually spending the money. And in fact, in states across the country, largely right-wing groups, although sometimes accompanied by a left-wing group, have been opposing efforts by the states to increase disclosure of who is spending the money behind these ads. And so what you'll see on the news, and one of the things we track extensively at PR Watch and at Source Watch, is the names of these groups and what we can discern about who they are and what we can glean from the very limited financial record of disclosure through the IRS about how much money they're spending. So I think it's an extraordinary crisis in our democracy, another enormous crisis, really, that is going to lead to the spending of billions of dollars in the presidential election campaign next year. And when the dust settles, we will have no idea under current law which financial interests, which corporations, which CEOs, which nonprofit entities passing money through other nonprofit entities actually is spending the money to run multi-million dollar ad campaigns in order to distort the outcome of that election in 2012.
How good of a job do you think the American news media are doing of covering this issue, of letting Americans be aware of this really dramatic change in the nature of the funding of our elections and what it means for our democracy?
Well, I have to tell you, I think they've done a very poor job. groups across the country, including my group, the Center for Media and Democracy, Public Citizen, People for the American Way, Common Cause, and others, have joined in calling for a constitutional amendment because there's really no way to undo the Supreme Court's decision, since they called it a constitutional requirement, than to amend the Constitution. There's been some limited coverage of some of the statutory fixes like shareholder consent or disclosure, which have gone nowhere in the politically divided Congress in Washington. But the fact is that this is huge business for the media industry, in particular for television. They're making, you know, millions and millions in profit on these ads. They have no interest in basically shutting down that market for themselves, especially with the tight budgets that some of these organizations face as part of, you know, multimedia conglomerates, or conglomerates that have nothing to do with media but own media companies. At the print level, in terms of the coverage of the issue, we have, you know, certainly seen some good stories, some good coverage, some good editorials. But the fact is that this is an extraordinary crisis, but it's also an extraordinary boon financially to the media industry to have this much money being spent in political campaign ads or in so-called issue ads by these shadowy groups.
Our guest, Lisa Graves, the executive director and editor-in-chief of the Center for Media and Democracy, based in Madison, Wisconsin. They can be learned about by going to their website, prwatch.org, or going to sourcewatch.org. We've got about 15 minutes left in the show. If you'd like to call at 333-9455 or our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Lisa, we've just barely touched the surface of the extent of the work that the Center for Media and Democracy has been doing over the last year or two, but one area I would be remiss not to go to immediately deals with exactly the sort of corporations that spend a lot on politics and lobbying, and that's the banks and the financial firms. And the Center has had a major project now, the Real Economy Project, and examining the financial industry specifically for a couple of years and what they're doing. And what can you tell our listeners that you've discovered?
Well, it's not pretty, Bob.
You're kidding. Where's the good news here anyway?
I know.
Where's the happy ending, Lisa?
Exactly. We have a project that's led by Mary Batari, who joined us from Public Citizen. She leads a project called the Real Economy Project, and we have a website that is related to that called Bankster USA. That's BANKSTERUSA.org. It's as in banker plus gangster equals bankster. That site tries to illuminate some of the pretty dense issues that are part of the debate over reforming Wall Street. A lot of our focus was last year when Wall Street reform was on the legislative agenda nationally, and there was a lot of public conversation about what to do about the gambling on derivatives that really led to the crash of our economy. And so we have been working to basically get the truth out, get the word out about what needs to be done to reform our economy, about what is really happening behind the scenes with some of these bills, what the truth is about some of the rhetoric regarding financial reform. But the fact is, as I think everyone knows, Congress, while it made some progress in contending with Wall Street, namely through the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Agency or Protection Board, it has been stymied. The Congress would not allow Elizabeth Warren to become the head of that new agency, which is designed to protect consumers in the financial markets. And largely, some of the most crucial reforms that were being pushed to regulate the derivatives market, which really emerged as a way to get around regulation of insurance and other financial products, that industry remains largely unregulated in many respects, that there have been efforts to rein in Wall Street, but Wall Street has spent literally millions of dollars lobbying against reform. And some of the same banks that received the bailout money have lobbied against reform. Some of the major corporations that have been involved in derivatives, like Koch Industries, have lobbied against reforms.
Now, Lisa, if I can just interrupt you, because in the news now for the last several weeks, and just including this morning, coming from Europe about the financial, you know, problems of the entire continent and several of the economies that threaten a return to a major crisis similar to 2008. I mean, it's teetering.
Right.
I mean, this seems to be directly related to what you're talking about.
Well, I think that's right. I think what we've seen here in the U.S. and it's certainly we've been seeing it abroad as well is that these financial interests are exerting extraordinary influence on the governments, not just of the United States but of other governments, and they have basically been pushing, in essence, not just for a lack of really substantial reforms to protect the economies, but also some of these same entities have been backing, in essence, a political agenda, which we and others call this austerity agenda, which would basically force the working people to pay for the crisis while the banks and others that got bailed out aren't paying increased taxes. And along with that, really a fire sale of some of the significant assets of the states, of the, you know, in the countries, public institutions, public buildings being sold to corporations or government services being either eliminated or spun off to corporations to run. And so this agenda that we've seen, this austerity agenda, which basically suggests that you cannot raise taxes on the richest Americans, you cannot raise taxes on the richest corporations, you can't even enforce really meaningful tax policy against the biggest corporations in the world, many of which are in the U.S. and are global corporations in these other countries, and instead you simply have to cut the benefits of ordinary people, and you have to have them pay their taxes, but the corporations, some corporations don't pay any taxes.
Let me cut you off there if I can, Lisa Graves, because the point's well taken. We have a few callers waiting patiently.
Oh, sure, sure. Sorry.
And I want to try to make sure we get to all of them. Let's start right now with line one. Champagne, you're on the air with Lisa Graves.
Yeah, my question is, as an aspiring student of journalism, among many right now, what can people like me do to sort of pick up the cause and fight against problems like this, like the Republican corporate agenda?
Great. That's a great question. Thank you very much. Lisa Graves?
Well, I think that there's a bipartisan corporate agenda, I would say. There's too many corporate politicians from both parties. But we certainly see that the revenue policies of trying to starve government and protect corporate wealth, certainly in the way it has evolved in Congress lately, has been a primarily Republican charge. But the fact is that I think that reforming our election process, getting some meaningful reform of getting the money out of politics, and this notion, this absurd notion that money is speech and can't be regulated, has to be thwarted, because otherwise we're going to continue to have politicians just do the bidding, in essence, of the highest bidder, of the corporations that are bankrolling their campaigns. From the standpoint of covering and reporting, I just think that we have to pursue the alternative outlets, the alternative media through social media, to really get these stories out, to do the interviews that the newspapers aren't doing, to do the interviews that some of the magazines aren't doing, with some exceptions, and help get the word out and share it as widely as possible.
You know, Lisa Graves, I'm just right now at your website looking at it, and I'm going through your staff profiles. This gets to the caller's question. There are, on your staff, numerous young people in their 20s who are journalism majors and journalists who are doing journalism for your group. And what that says to me is that for better or for worse, for a young person who wants to do investigative journalism, who wants to really cover the important political and social issues going on in this country in a meaningful way, the traditional news media isn't offering necessarily the best possible route at this point. There might be some jobs there, but they might have to go in a different direction to one of the many big-paying jobs in the nonprofit sector.
or low-paying jobs.
Or non-paying jobs, which is the tragedy.
Well, you know, we do pay our interns and our students, because we think that it's morally, you know, essential, obviously, and we know everyone has bills to pay. And so we don't have a huge budget, but we are committed to providing opportunities for students to be involved in genuine investigative journalism, in our view, to really dig in and report the truth about the powers that be, about these powerful interests. And so under my leadership of the center, we've had numerous students over the last 2 years join us and really commit with supervision and with some, you know, certainly guidance to exposing these stories, exposing the truth.
I mean, I suspect you've seen, and I know some of the students or young people who write for the center, what I've seen in my travels around the United States, and I see in Champaign-Urbana, which is that there is a generation of really talented young people that really want to do great journalism and that are extremely frustrated by the lack of there being any institutions to support them.
That's right. I mean, I think that we hear a lot of frustration, and we see a tremendous pressure through the J schools, the journalism schools, and through the sort of the market, in essence, to push them into PR roles, to have them be, in essence, PR flacks rather than journalists. I think a lot of people who've gone into journalism, students have gone because they care about the truth. They're maybe cynical at heart, or at least skeptical. They have a healthy dose of skepticism, and I don't think they went to school with all their idealism just to push the product line or the party line, although some do. Some really want to have that sort of cash out and get those PR careers. But a lot of students want to report. They want to tell the truth, and they see it's not being told. And so we and a number of other nonprofits have been, you know, working to enlist this next generation in helping to report the truth that isn't being reported in the mainstream media.
Our guest, Lisa Grace, let's go back to the phone lines again. Now we're going to go to Ann Arbor, Michigan, line 4. You're on the air.
Oh, hi there. Hi. I'm on the air?
You are indeed.
Okay. I wanted to go back to an earlier comment that your guest today made regarding ALEC. And, I mean, I completely agree with everything that you say here, but I feel I want to ask a devil's advocate question on a point that I think needs to really be kind of substantiated and well-developed to drive the stake through the heart of the ALEC vampire, which is, earlier you said, you commented that corporations will vote on ALEC model legislation before it's ever submitted to any state legislature for anything. So my devil's advocate question is, what's the big deal? I mean, you know, we have democratic institutions. If, you know, these, you know, guys and their lobbyists are, you know, partying and whatever else, and they come up with really bad ideas, won't it just get kicked out by our, you know, by these our venerable institutions of government? So with that, I'll hang up and listen to an answer.
Thank you very much, caller. Lisa Graves?
Sure. Well, I used to be a lobbyist for the ACLU, and all I had was truth and shame. We weren't PAC donors. We didn't have access to members. And it's certainly the case that corporations have a wide level of access to legislators and work to get their bills in their hands. ALEC's different because it's not just the act of asking the legislators to take up their bills. It's the act of sitting in a room behind closed doors and voting with them in favor of that legislation before it's introduced. It's kind of like a pinky swear, or not quite a blood oath. Then some of those legislators come back to their state house and introduce it, and they don't want it changed. And we've seen in Wisconsin and other states some of this legislation just ram through despite the political process, despite the potential possibility of amending it, because it's part of delivering the goods, in essence, to these corporate benefactors. So,
I mean, Lisa, if I can interject, too. I mean, sure. It seems to me, when I've read your material and I've read the reports on ALEC and how they operate, that, you know, you basically have a body that operates secretly that generates the legislation. And then theoretically, yeah, our legislators can vote it down once it gets to the floor. But the whole legislative process is now privatized. I mean, the whole process of generating, having hearings, doing everything that leads to the actual legislation no longer is a public process.
Well, I think that that's significant. While some bills do come out from the legislators, many of them really are corporate-derived. They come from the corporate lobbyists. And ALEC itself, in essence, provides these their own sort of hearings, in a way, these sessions for the legislators to basically convince them that they're right. They go back and they're already basically convinced by the legislation before there's been a public hearing at all. And in some instances, these politicians are pushing things through without even having a public hearing. Or
Lisa Grace, do you hear the music in the background?
I do.
Tuning up. They want to clear me out of the studio. That means this show's about to wrap. Lisa Grace, thanks for taking time out from your Sunday to join us today in Media Matters.
Bob, thank you so much.
Lisa Graves, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. Go to prwatch.org to learn more. I want to thank Kyle Croha, my engineer, Melissa Trentz, my producer, for their great work. We're going to be back in 167 hours with Mark Weisbrot talking about politics and the economy. What else on Media Matters? I'm Bob McChesney. Everyone, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Here's your weather forecast. Today is cloudy with a high near 63. Tonight, 80% chance of showers and possibly a thunderstorm before 1 a.m., low around 51. Tomorrow, 30% chance of showers after 1 p.m., mostly cloudy with a high near 64. Tomorrow night, 50% chance of showers, cloudy with a low around 51. This is Illinois Public Media.